Hello and welcome to Ask the Mayor here on WBAA News. I'm your host, Emily Seiberg. This week, we're talking with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. Thanks so much for being with us. As you're listening, remember you can always email your questions for the mayor today and for any of our mayors to ask, that's A-S-K, at WBAA.org. Welcome to the show, Mayor Barton.
Hello, good to be here as always.
Absolutely. So when you and I talked last month, the governor had just announced the statewide mask mandate would be changed to a mask advisory on April 6th, and Crawfordsville and Montgomery County followed the state's lead on this, did not impose stricter local guidelines. So wanted to check in, how has the lifting of that mandate played out over the past 3 weeks or so in Crawfordsville?
Well, things seem to have gone well. I think everybody is respecting other people's views. And if they choose to wear a mask, I haven't heard any instances where people have been, given any problem for that. And if some businesses are choosing or people are choosing not to, I've not heard anything there either. So it's really largely been left up to businesses to just determine what they need to do inside their own business. And certainly there are recommendations out there and we encourage people to follow those recommendations. But at the end, we were just really looking at the data and there's not been significant changes in that data. In fact, we're at blue status right now.
I saw that.
Mm-hmm. We had a meeting today with the health officer and he feels like we'll kind of bounce back and forth between yellow and blue. But other than the possibility of some issues with the different variants, we think we're in pretty solid shape right now.
So how are local businesses handling the mandate, I guess, broadly? Are most of them maintaining some kind of rule about masking in their business? Have people been letting it go? What can you tell us about that?
Well, I think it's a mix. I would say that more are requiring it than are not requiring it. It's usually posted right on the door so people understand when they go in. But if you go into the big box stores, it looks pretty similar to what it did before. I don't see big changes there. But it does put businesses, in a tough spot. As I've said before, restaurant owners know that some of their customers will not come in if a mask is required, and other customers will not come in if it's not required. So it does put them in a very tough spot.
So, as the leader of your local government, something that I've been talking about with other mayors and other officials is, what can that business owner do if they find themselves in a really tough spot? What's their recourse if they need a little extra help, a little backup?
Well, I think reach out to those of us in local government and reach out to the health department and the health officer and really discuss your individual situation. And, it's different in every business. I mean, we have to understand that businesses are laid out differently. They have different things happening inside that business. And I think it just warrants a conversation with the professionals to really allow you to make a good informed decision.
And I wanted to get a progress report on vaccinations in your area.
Right.
Is supply meeting demand, not meeting demand? Is it starting to exceed demand?
Yeah, so we just got a report this morning on this. And, right now, 25.9% of residents in Montgomery County age 16 and above who are eligible have been fully vaccinated. So 25.9%, 37.2% have received their first dose. So we're doing at least their first dose. So we're doing really well there. And what we're starting to see right now is the trends are changing. And right now, supply is actually exceeding demand. Mm-hmm. We've seen the demand drop pretty significantly in the last couple of weeks. We're still giving a lot of vaccines. That's still happening. I'm not saying that. But, I know the health department said that they had asked the state to maybe cut back on what they were shipping to us because it wasn't, necessarily being used. And they have, I think they said this coming Saturday, maybe 2/3 of their appointment slots are full, maybe a little over half. So we have seen demand drop. And that's not unique to Crawfordsville or Montgomery County. That's happening all over the state and all over the country.
So I guess you mentioned some numbers of people who have been vaccinated. Was the health department able to present any kind of data on the drop off? What kind of percentages are we talking about there?
Well, we don't know. There's a lot of unanswered questions, and there was a lot of good discussion about that in our meeting today. And it's really, you're starting to reach the part of the population that's kind of on the fence and not sure what they're going to do. So the question is, how do we get good, solid, accurate information to them so they can make a decision? And even how do you encourage, maybe even entice people to maybe, get off the fence and get this done? So we don't really have the answers there yet, but we are having, I think, very good conversations about how we continue to promote this and move this forward with those people who just legitimately are not sure what they want to do.
Did you find, we've been having conversations with our local health department in Tippecanoe County just today about the possible impact of the Johnson & Johnson vaccination pause. How has that played out, do you think, in terms of vaccine hesitation over the past week or so?
Well, we suspect it's a factor. I mean, there's no data to show that that's precisely what's happened, but that's about the same time that the health department started to see the kind of the decline in the requests for appointments. So there's no doubt that it's probably a factor. We're just not sure how much of a factor it really is, because if someone was on the fence or hesitant, that would certainly give them reason to pause and maybe think that they should hold off to see what happens, you know.
So it also, it looks like the health department, you know, sponsored a special vaccination clinic geared towards students who are currently only eligible to receive the Pfizer vaccine. You know, we've talked about other specialized vaccine initiatives in the county before, kind of that boutique kind of experience,
right,
kind of different and special. I guess, what's the thought process about employing some of those creative methods of reaching people where they are, to mitigate some of this, to mitigate the hesitancy and reach out to people?
Right. Well, you know, we've been doing a lot of that, and I think we have more kind of in the works, if you will. We're talking through some different scenarios, but you know, you have to accept the fact that for some people, the hesitation might just be logistics. You know, I mean, maybe they're a little on the fence, but, you know, how do I schedule this in? People are busy. They have a lot going on. How do I schedule a time? You know, I have to do that, and then I have to show up someplace. If we can bring it to them, we know we'll reach more people. That's all there is to it. So that's really been the thought process. And the thought with the schools was that, you know, it's difficult for a lot of these students. They have after-school activities. They have stuff on the weekends. If we can make it easy and convenient, we know that we'll reach a lot of students. And that was what we tried to do there. The numbers were lower than what we thought they might be. I mean, we didn't think they would be super high, but they were still a little bit lower than what we thought. But, you know, every student we reach is a win. So we have to just keep pushing ahead.
So in terms of, you know, we're talking about who, you know, students who are currently eligible, which again is only Pfizer at this point. Have we started thinking about how to efficiently roll out, you know, that broader school-aged vaccination clinic as more kids become eligible, maybe into the summer and ahead of next school year?
We are. We're working through that right now, and we certainly have a leg up on doing that in this community, because our mobile integrated health with our community paramedics, they're already in the elementary and middle schools doing normal childhood immunizations. So they already have a model in place. They already have those relationships. I know they were out last Friday morning, giving normal immunizations, and it's kind of scary to accept this, but what we see is that, you know, in some of our schools, a third of the children in the schools do not have their normal childhood immunizations. They're not up to date.
Mm-hmm.
That was a problem going into the pandemic. It has gotten markedly worse during the pandemic. So we have a program in place. We have a full-time community paramedic who's focused on addressing childhood immunizations, and that will spill right over into COVID if we have a vaccine for COVID for those younger ages.
Well, and I think too, when we start talking about a 12-year-old, for example, we're not doing COVID, you know, COVID-19 vaccine outreach to a 12-year-old. Then we're talking about almost outreach to their parent or guardian.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
And so, obviously, does that turn into a little bit of a different conversation? Let's say we're still dealing with hesitancy. You know, how do you work with the parents who themselves might not want to get that vaccination and encourage them to get it for their children?
Right. There's a whole another piece to this when you start talking about those issues, and that's where we really have to bring the professionals to the table and follow their guidance about how to really effectively communicate, to give them information to make this decision. And that goes not only for the COVID vaccine, but all the vaccines. I'm confident the right people are at the table, and they will design a program that's solid and provides good, accurate information for parents to make decisions. And at the end of the day, we'll make it easy for them to get these vaccines and really create a healthier community and a healthier school community.
You are listening to Ask the Mayor on WBAA News. I'm your host, Emily Seiberg, and right now we're talking with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. So, Mayor, we touched on this very briefly before the show. This is moving very quickly, even today. So, another issue that's arisen as a point of debate nationally in Indiana as well is the concept of the COVID-19 vaccine passport. So, just this morning, a bill passed in Indiana's House and Senate is now headed to the governor, with including language that bars state and local governments from using or requiring such a passport. And I guess as a side note, I'd say too, I think a point that's been raised is that maybe the word passport hits some people in the wrong way. Maybe it needs to be something like a verification. But you're talking about
Right.
immunizations for students. You know, specific immunizations are already required for entry into certain countries. Proof of immunizations, longstanding requirement at schools, of course, with certain exceptions. So what is different about this? Why is this so different?
Well, I think that the key thing that I keep hearing is that the COVID vaccine has only been approved under emergency use authorization. So it's very difficult to compare it to the other vaccines and the other immunizations because it's not at that level yet. It doesn't have that kind of approval. And we've been told all along, as an employer, you might be able to require certain vaccines with your employees, but you can't require this because it doesn't have full approval yet. It's only here under that emergency use authorization. So that's probably the biggest factor. But really, if you look at what the legislature is doing here, I don't know that it really means that much, and they probably don't like me saying that. But if you think the Indiana legislature is going to have the last say in what happens there, I think you're wrong because I think the feds will weigh in, and they always have the leverage to create a uniform approach across the country. So through interstate travel and things like that. So I think that story is long from being over.
Well, and you're talking about the emergency use authorization, ostensibly down the line, it will be officially approved.
Oh, definitely.
And so that will kind of stop being part of the argument, though I certainly
Yes.
see what you're saying.
Yeah.
And you and I have talked before about the state kind of dictating what can happen on the local level. I know you have thoughts about that.
I have very strong thoughts about
So, well,
that.
right. So how do you feel about something like this, where they're kind of saying you cannot do this particular this thing?
Well, that's no surprise. I mean, that just falls right in line with everything that we see happening. I know you had the news story on about the heavier weights with the trucks,
Right.
and I mean, you just have to stop. At some point, you have to stop and ask yourself who your legislators are representing. I it just doesn't make sense, some of the things that happen, because if you look at the impact on highway safety and infrastructure and things like that. There are plenty of, I think, very valid concerns and questions. And to see something kind of just cruise through like that, you just have to scratch your head.
Well, and legislation, if we're, continuing to kind of loop in COVID measures, which has, obviously been a big topic this past legislative session. Legislation was approved yesterday. Again, local health officials have to get approval from county commissioners, city council to pass emergency restrictions that are stricter than the states. How do you see all of that playing out down the line? I know that you have frequently spoken of the collaborative nature, the interactions between all of the agencies that have to work on this stuff in Montgomery County. So now some of this stuff might be a little more set in stone. Again, what are the issues that could come up in the future? Or do you think that, you're in an area where you're uniquely suited, to keep collaborating?
Well, I do think we're uniquely suited, but I do see the big picture, and you know what you're seeing here is you know the pendulum swinging back and forth, and there was no doubt, and I've said all along, there will be a reaction to what's happened over the last year, and we're seeing that play out, you know, with this legislative action. But you know, in the end, I think what everybody's after is there has to be some accountability in the system, and that's been my concern as we've progressed through this. And I'm not talking about last February, March, April, even May. I'm talking about September, October, and into this year. There just didn't seem to be any accountability. And, you know, as an elected official, you answer to the public. You're going to make decisions that they agree with and decisions that they don't agree with. But you try to look at all the information and make the best possible decision. You have to listen to the health professionals. You have to look at everything in the big picture and make those decisions. And the concern was that we have people in positions that can implement these restrictions that are have a huge impact on people's lives, has a huge impact on businesses, and they're not answerable. They're not elected. There's no direct accountability there. And that's what they were after, and that's what they're restoring. So I don't necessarily disagree with that. I think it should be signed off on by the elected officials who are accountable and have to answer to the constituents in the community.
So I'm going to change topics here. Obviously, very big news this week with the Derek Chauvin trial. And you and I have talked over the past year about, you know, initiatives around policing and racial equity in Crawfordsville that you started to kind of set in motion starting last summer. I guess, first of all, what is your reaction to the events of this week and to the verdict?
You know, no surprise there. I mean, I think everybody who had watched that play out, you know, I mean, everybody I know in law enforcement will tell you that, you know, what they saw in that video was not proper and should not have happened that way. So there were no surprises when that verdict was handed down. And I think the country has, you know, I don't want to say accepted that, but I think they understand that the reality of that situation. I tried to really avoid social media, you know, the day of that verdict because I saw very bad behavior across the political spectrum. You know, if the goal is to bring us together and have conversations and heal, there were people, you know, on every side of that who were doing the opposite. You know, you can't do that. You have to pull people together. So, you know, no real surprises there. I'm proud of where we're at in this community. You know, we felt like we were way ahead of the curve on this. Our policies already excluded some of the things that you saw happen in Minneapolis. We formed our special commission. They went through our policies last summer, recommended a couple of wording changes. We adopted those. So we had all those things in place, and the commission's done good work. They've been kind of hamstrung by the pandemic because as you try to bring the public together for conversations during a pandemic, you run into issues. But they had two events just in the last 2 weeks to facilitate those community conversations. And I'm very anxiously awaiting kind of the summary of those meetings. The Wabash Democracy and Public Discourse hosted those. One was virtual, one was at Pike Place. And I'm really anxious to see kind of what was said and how that conversation went. I was not at either event, and that's very intentional, and it's very difficult for me to do. But I, when we have those types of events, and I've gone to those before with the WDPD, if I'm there, it tends to influence or change the conversation. And I want people to feel very free about saying anything. And I don't want them, I don't want to be there and everyone looking at me and then kind of changes the dialogue. So we know going into it that I will sit on the sidelines and stay out of the way so that this conversation can happen. And then I'll take the results of it and we'll go from there. So I'm going to get a report on that probably next week. And I'm pretty excited to see what was said and what happened.
So, you know, just in the past, you know, week, 10 days or so, there have been other police shootings, you know, some high profile incidents. We're still talking about this. You know, so what progress have we made and work what work needs to continue to be done? You know, and as a mayor, what is your role in all of this? You know, you spoke to that just a little bit now, kind of staying out of the way and then coming in when you feel like
Right.
it's needed, but What do we still need to do?
I said all along, we have to create a system of law enforcement in which everybody shares equally in their confidence. And I think we've been doing that in our community. You have to have openness and transparency here. Every officer wears a body camera. We're very open and transparent about what's happening. But I also think, you know, if you look at some of this, there's some responsibility that goes across the board with everybody. And to keep allowing behavior where people just push the envelope and push the envelope is not the answer either. You know, when you're allowing these situations and encouraging these situations in which people are fleeing and they're fighting and all those kind of things, it just adds fuel to the fire and really creates the environment where something can go wrong. And we have to really have, I think, solid discussions within our community about, you know, respect for law enforcement and law enforcement respecting the community. It goes both ways, and how we can facilitate that so that things don't go awry. And that's what we're seeing happen in a lot of these cases.
So how, if we're talking about a two-way street here and we're talking about educating a community about what law enforcement does, how can you do that in Crawfordsville? You know, how do you bring people to the table for that kind of conversation?
Well, you know, it's about having those community conversations, and the commission is planning some events this summer in which we really foster that communication and dialogue between law enforcement and the community. And ultimately, you know, it's about exposing the community to kind of what they're doing and why they're doing it. And that goes a long way. Answering any questions they have, and we still encourage, you know, there's some restrictions, but we encourage citizens to go out and do a ride along, you know, to understand kind of what's happening on that side of it. When an officer makes a traffic stop, why they do the things they do. If people understand that and they realize that it's not just for reasons, you know, that they read on the internet, it really does go a long way. So it is about fostering that dialogue and communication and understanding. And hopefully we'll have quite a few events this year involving the law enforcement community and the greater community.
I think something I've seen, the argument that I've seen made addressing some, you know, recent shootings, you know, questions about how quickly police respond in the moment with deadly force. You know, is that something that I would say that would be specifically something people would certainly need to have a full understanding of, those few seconds, those moments where law enforcement is deciding what to do. And so I think, again, that's where a lot of the emotion and debate is around, you know, why shoot when you could use a taser? What happens when this happens? What do you decide to do if, you know, just kind of that checklist, I guess, and how that unfolds so quickly in some of these instances.
And it's not it's not a case of making a decision in seconds. It's a fraction of a second, you know, when these decisions are made. And that's, officers are human at the end of the day. And that's just the reality. You know, we have to make sure that we have as highly trained officers out there as we can. And I'm confident in our community. I have absolute confidence in their training, that we have highly professional people. But you're putting them in situations that require those split second decisions. And it can be very, very difficult. I think we have to expose the public to that reality. I know sometimes locally they bring in the simulators and they allow members of the media and the public to participate in that, to really understand what it's like to have to make that decision when the person jumps out of the car, friend or foe, you know, what's going on. They're reaching in the back of the truck. Are they grabbing a cane so they can walk? Are they grabbing a weapon? You know, split second decisions like that are very difficult. And the more we can help people understand that, so that when they have a situation that they encounter law enforcement, so that they can understand how their actions can be perceived and why there's maybe law enforcement is a little on edge. It's just better for everyone. It just is better for everyone. And we're going to work very hard at improving that communication. I think that, you know, a really fair criticism here locally was that law enforcement had been kind of segmented off from the greater community and didn't interact enough. And we're going to change that.
Okay. So another opportunity for you to weigh in on some statewide news. A final state budget proposal was rolled out this week And I don't know if you've had a chance to take a look at some of the finer points or the larger points, but I know that $500 million of the budget will be put towards a new regional economic recovery program. What, if anything, have you heard from the state about what that kind of program might entail or how local officials could be involved in that process?
Well, we've not heard much other than it, you know, it's in there. What that looks like and how that plays out, I'm not really sure. I think Governor Holcomb has made it very clear that he's very much behind regionalism and that approach. And so that's what you're seeing play out here. And there are pros and cons to that. You know, there are definitely some strong arguments to be made for the regional approach. There are also some drawbacks. So like everything else, and like the Federal Rescue Act money that's flowing into the state, the proof will be, or the results will be, in how it's administered. You know, is it administered in a fair way, and in a timely way, and in a way that allows us to get things done, or does it get hung up in the process? And it's the same thing here. We'll just have to see how that plays out and how the agencies are actually administering this, because the regional approach in the past has really been pretty much focused in the Fort Wayne area and the Evansville area.
Okay.
That's about it. So, you know, it's going to have to look at different regions, Lafayette being one of those. Mm-hmm. And here in Crawfordsville, we kind of get torn in that a little bit, because we're kind of geographically, it makes sense to lump us in Lafayette. And if you look, you know, logistically, we kind of fall in that Indianapolis area. We're kind of in between. So it puts us in a kind of a challenging spot.
So where are you at now with Crawfordsville's specific federal aid process? I believe the last time we talked about this, you had sat through some online, what's the word I'm searching for here?
Webinars. Online meetings. Mm-hmm. I've sat through several, and I'm confused still. So,
okay.
I mean, we know what we need to do first. We need to create the account to park the money, and then we need to really decide priorities as a community and kind of work through, as far as what exactly we can and cannot do. That's where it still gets a little fuzzy for me. We know there are some things we can do. There's no doubt. I mean, there's some infrastructure things. There's public health things, which we're already doing a lot. So we could really shore that up. We can use it to offset some lost revenue, which in our case is not a lot, but mm-hmm. there's a formula for calculating that. So I'm sure we'll do that. But aside from that, we're not really clear. And, you know, you have to understand this money has to be used in a pretty tight time frame.
What is the time frame for using the money?
So I think like 24.
Okay.
So, I mean, that sounds like a lot of time. But in the world
maybe
of designing,
not to a mayor, yes.
Yeah, in the world of designing projects and implementing projects, that's pretty tight. So we'll have to see kind of where we go. I hope to have a clear picture and a real conversation with the city council and the community in the coming months.
All right, that is our time for today, Mayor. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
You can find this program at our website, wbaa.org, along with an archive of our shows with the mayors of Lafayette, West Lafayette, Crawfordsville, and Frankfort. Send us your questions for all four mayors to ask@wbaa.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great rest of the day.